And welcome all to the Q&A session. As I mentioned before, we welcome guests at any time at the Auto PCS Group meetings, whether it's Q&A or our regular monthly meetings. If you want to join, it's just $20 a year, and we do have a special on right now. If you join before March 31st, then you can get 2 years for the price of one. So I've just muted all. Everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or a comment. Remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. If I hear background noise during the evening and it's not related to what's going on in the meeting, then I will unceremoniously mute you, and you'll have to re-unmute yourself if you want to talk.
Chris, you need to make me co-host so I can share my screen.
Oh, my apologies, Alan, of course. I am negligent in my duties. There you go. Okay, so I think that's it for announcements. So I think we can. The last thing, of course, is as usual. Later on this evening, thanks to Alan's hard work, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website, so you can review any of the material from Q&A if you need to. And with that, I will pass it on to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so I think we have left off. I'm going to start off with the results from the survey I sent out earlier last week. I'm sure you got the email. It said, "What one thing would you like to know about relating to computers?" So what I did was I took the membership list and the announcements list and I merged them together and eliminated any duplicates. And that gave me over 300 email addresses. And I got 37 replies back for a massive 12% response rate. So we've got a limited number of responses. And so don't take these numbers as absolute gospel. But I basically took all, this is a free form response. You could type anything you wanted. So rather than go through everything with a fine tooth comb, one by one, I just threw the whole lot at ChatGPT and asked it to pull out the major categories, major response categories, and this is what I got. Now, again, almost a third of the people were interested in security and privacy of some sort or another. The categories here, the subcategories here are kind of generated by ChatGPT. So they may be multiple responses, they may be individual responses, and they may be a summary of the response. So when you see the things here, Chris and I will be going through the actual responses in some detail, and we will put together some slides. I'll talk about that later on. But you can see here, generally, people were interested in general security, password managers, VPNs, and settings in Windows, for example. So lots of different security-related things there that people were interested in. The second biggest category, almost a quarter of the people, were interested in various aspects of data management, including backups and file recovery, cleaning up PCs, sharing photographs, organizing files, and that sort of thing. And the other thing I mentioned is that some of these things we have covered before. Some of the things are new, and we'll take a look at those. Even the ones we've covered before, we'll probably revisit them in some kind of format in order to respond to these requests that we've got. The third category that ChatGPT came up with was hardware and buying hardware, and 17% of the people were interested in that. Seems to be an emphasis on mini PCs, including Raspberry Pis, single board computers, and the specs for new hardware, and so on and so forth. So we'll take a look at some of that. And then fourth category was operating systems, both Linux, I'm happy to say, and Windows. And so migration and updates from Windows 10 to Windows 11, choosing Linux, running it on older PCs, An interesting one here, comparing Google OS with Windows 11. Google OS is on its way. It hasn't actually been released yet, as far as I know. So, again, there's a topic that we'll probably take a look at in future. And then the final quantity, of course, was artificial intelligence, just over 10%. Had various things on AI, how to use it, how to apply it to children and retirement planning and doing things with documents. So those are the kind of things we've heard from already. And we can probably help, as it says right here, but we really do need to know what it is that you need to know. If you tell us what your problem is, we can probably come up with an answer. We can find somebody who can come up with an answer. And that includes both computers and smartphones and tablets and the various software products that are applicable to the different hardware systems. So if you have any questions, then send it to suggestion box, as Chris mentioned earlier on. Okay, I just pulled out a couple of the things that were asked for, basically because we have covered them. So if we take a while to get around to some of these again, I just wanted to point you to the things that we've done previously. A couple of people wanted to know about buying new computers and setting them up. And I remind you that back in 2021, back in 2021, Chris and I did a mini series of articles on setting up a new computer, and that included like how you actually start off, how you back it up, and how you maintain the thing up to date. So those three articles are a good start, and the information included in there, I'm sure there are links and things to other sources of information. There was a few people wanted to know about backup, and we certainly talked about how to back systems up a number of times. And the thing that comes to my mind instantly is Chris's OPL presentations, and he's going to be doing his backup presentation on February 26th at the Manatee branch. So if you live in Manatee, there's a no-brainer. If you don't live in Manatee, it's not that far away. You could always go down there and attend the session. However, again, we've talked about these things in the newsletter, and if you're a Windows person, then Chris's article on finding a backup program, he basically recommended ESUS to do backup, which is a Windows app. And if you're Windows and Linux, or Linux exclusively, then my recommendation would be Foxconn, which is a bootable USB that will deal with any kind of operating system on a hard drive. And in terms of trading up between Windows 10 and Windows 11, we've certainly had information on that. In fact, last week, Harvey, that was his topic for a share, was how to upgrade from Windows 10 to Windows 11. So there's the link for last week's Q&A presentation. And, of course, the audio file is available on the website, too. There was a question came in that series of what do you want to know. And it's basically this one. Is anybody using the latest Raspberry Pi, which is a Raspberry Pi 5, as a standard old LAMP server? Now, LAMP is short for Linux Operating System, Apache as a web server, MySQL as a database, and PHP for web coding. And in particular, using a Raspberry Pi 5 with cloud storage capabilities using the OwnCloud software. And this is from Jeff, and he's considering dumping an old desktop, in favor of a high efficiency, fairly powerful, and very small Raspberry Pi 5. So if anybody has experience with the Pi 5, and especially if you have experience in that kind of environment, please let us know. In fact, if you have any experiences like with pies, please let us know. It's a really interesting topic, and people are always interested to learn more about it. So if you have any insights into that and want to give us a share or even a full monthly presentation, we'd be happy to hear about that. Okay, Chris, there must be something in chat here, I see.
Nothing about those in particular, but we did have a whole bunch of things going into chat. We do have a link from Mavo on a link to tweaking Windows, if anybody's interested in that. And we have a question from Mike Lapp on, for Windows 11, how to deal with bad updates. Comment on AI, Mark Carney, saying that a third of Quebec, Tom, you unleashed something here. One third of Quebec students having used AI for help with schoolwork. Interesting. And Aaron O'Driscoll, Elizabeth O'Driscoll says, I don't need to know this, but it's interesting. The new evolution of the web is called Solid, from Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web. And I think that's it for right now. Oh, Andrew P. has, my webpage may help with getting started with Pi, and he has a link there if anybody is interested in the slide that's on the screen. Maybe you can get some help there. That's okay. It so far.
All right. Thanks, Chris. All right, so the next item is yours.
Was it mine? Oh, yes, okay, this came in from Jennifer, and I emailed Jennifer today to see, ask if there was anything, any update on this one here.
I have an answer, Chris.
Oh, okay. Jen, yes, go ahead.
Okay, hold on here. Okay. My answer is, so the problem was the GPU. It didn't support a secure boot when it was in a BIOS, and then it kind of just didn't work. So what happened was we had to take out the GPU, take out the battery, put the battery back in, swap it out with a different GPU, plug everything back in, boot it up in the BIOS, turn back on the CSM support, save everything, make sure it worked, and then check the Windows boot. Do step one again, which was to take out the GPU, replace it with the original GPU. So you need a new GPU to reset it if you go in and you try to do something in your motherboard or your, if your motherboard or your GPU doesn't like it.
Okay. Well, that's really good that you managed to find an answer for it. I just go quickly through the slides. Jen had a problem with a specific motherboard and trying to get secure boot on for a game to work. And then everything went haywire and couldn't get anything on the screen. Had flashing lights on the RGB and things like that. And now there we go. Whoops. Windows or Zoom tends to not like my first clicks, and then it catches up. So I tried all kinds of things, and none of those worked. And I did a look at Perplexity AI, and it had some suggestions. And it had a bunch of things that you could try, but what was interesting I found was that if all else fails, unfortunately, this is soft bricking some of those motherboards, and the last solution was replace the motherboard. So I'm glad that you found a solution that was shy of that. And if anybody wants to read more about Perplexity AI's suggestions and so forth, I pasted in the URL to the query at Perplexity. So
I just have one more thing to say, Chris.
Sure.
So I remember I replaced the card with, like, I bought it and it was a mining card. Someone was Bitcoin mining off of it. So apparently some of these cards don't have all the functions available for what my son was trying to do, because they're just meant for Bitcoin mining. They're not meant to like really operate a system full up. So I guess that's something to watch for if you're looking to buy cards that were built for just Bitcoin mining in the past, because they are on the market now that people don't really do it anymore. They don't make any money off of it. So anyway, that's what I
thought of. Okay, thanks.
Question. Jen, were you able to replace the original GPU afterwards?
Yeah. So everything was reset in the computer, and then the old GPU could go back in, and it could talk to the computer however it does that.
Okay, I think we've done with that topic, so we'll move along. Thanks, Chris and Jen. Okay, so next up we have an item from Harvey. Kind of a different spin on Windows 11. This is a custom build of Windows 11, and Harvey's going to tell us all about Tiny 11.
Alrighty, thanks, Alan. So, yes, Tiny 11, I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but this build is related to the Windows 11 25H2 version. So it's a custom build, and it eliminates a lot of the built-in apps and optional components because it reduces the size and the system demand for running it. So essentially, Tiny 11 is designed to run on low-end or unsupported hardware. Now, it performs a clean install rather than in place, as we discussed last week. It does keep the core OS, but it removes a lot of the consumer-focused types of apps and features, which is people consider as bloatware. So that's the list below that it will eliminate a lot of different things. You know, when it comes to a browser, you have to put your own browser on, that type of thing. Go ahead, Alan. Okay, so what remains? Well, we have the Windows 11 core system. So that's all the kernel drivers, the update stack, that all remains. The basic security features such as Windows Defender and Firewall will remain. Notable changes. So it will bypass TPM if your CPU is not recognized as valid for Windows 11, it'll bypass that. And of course, any secure boot checks. So you can get past that. And you don't require a Microsoft account when you set this up. You just use a local. So telemetry and some of the background services may be reduced for performance and privacy. They own. So let's find out if it's suitable for your specific computer. So as I say, this is for low-end and unsupported type computers. Now, it's best suited for, as I say, those types of computers. If your CPU is not recognized by Microsoft, or you have TPM or secure boot not supported, that type of thing, it'll bypass those requirements. Now, I've run this on systems with 2 gigabytes of RAM, so it's, as an example here, if you have 2 to 4, it will run, and if you have limited storage. Now, if you looked up the Windows 11 minimum requirements, it'll tell you 4 gigabytes of RAM. Now, if you can believe that, well, good luck. But anyway, devices that struggle with the Windows 11 performance. So if you have an old laptop or desktop, this is something that you may want to consider. Now, if you're just doing light tasks, browsing, et cetera, maybe a little bit of email and whatnot, then this should work well on that computer. I have an older Dell Inspiron computer with 8 gigabytes of memory, and I'm running it on that. So it seems to work just fine. Go ahead, Alan. All right, now this is a little flowchart here. So we're going to be so-called building a US boot drive. So on your build computer, we're going to download the Windows 11 25H2 ISO. And from GitHub, we're going to download what they call the Tiny 11 Builder. Now, in File Explorer, we're going to mount the Windows 11 ISO. And again, that will give you a different drive letter. So in PowerShell, we're going to create the Tiny 11 ISO. So it's going to strip things down. Now, after you do that, we're going to feed that stripped down ISO into Rufus and create the USB boot drive. Now we're going to move over to your target computer, the one that you want to install Tiny 11 onto, and we're going to boot it up with the USB boot drive and perform the installation. Go ahead, Alan. All right, so on the build computer, as we mentioned, we're going to download your Windows 11 ISO right from Microsoft. And from GitHub, it'll be the Tiny 11 Builder script. And then we'll run that into PowerShell to process the ISO into a lightweight Tiny 11 version. So there's the steps. We're going to download it from Microsoft. It's a large file, 6.3 gigs. And under the download Windows 11, you want to select the 25H2. In this case, it's 25H2. Now we're going to download the Tiny 11 Builder script. That's the link for that. We're going to click on Code button and then click on Download Zip. And we extract that zip. That'll go back into, I believe it's the area where your ISO is also. Go ahead, Alan. All right, now creating the ISO. So we are going to mount that ISO file that we previously asked to mount. It will give you a drive letter, so make sure you note that. Open your Start menu. Get PowerShell running with Administrator. And in the PowerShell window, we're going to run the following command. And that'll just ensure that any commands you are issuing will actually run. We're going to navigate to the folder where you extracted the builder script. We're going to right-click on this particular PowerShell script name, and we're going to run it. Follow the on-screen prompts, confirm that letter for the mounted ISO, and it'll select the Windows edition to create your custom de-bloated Tiny ISO file. So the Tiny ISO file is created in the same folder as where your Windows 11 ISO will be located. Go ahead, Alan. Now, we're ready to make the Tiny 11 USB, the bootable USB. So we're going to use Rufus. That's the screen just to the right there. And that's where you can pick it up from. There's a link to download and install it. You open Rufus, and we're going to select the device where to create the bootable USB drive. In our example at the top, it says Kingston Drive B. We're going to select the Tiny 11 ISO. Correct, Alan. Thank you. and we're going to choose Standard Windows Installation. We can then click Start and follow the prompts to create the USB drive. Go ahead, Al. All right, now on the target computer, we're going to insert the bootable USB, restart the target computer, and press the boot menu key. So depending on what computer you have, it's one of those F12, F2, or delete key. And we're going to select the USB drive that we created. Now we're going to proceed with the Windows installation as usual. You're going to get prompted to where to install it. So you're going to have to delete any existing partitions on your target drive. Then select the unallocated space partition and click Next. Follow the on-screen instructions to finish setting up your user account. Once you're finished the whole install, you're going to have to run some Windows updates. Ensure your system restore is active. So Tiny 11 removes many default apps, so you'll need to install any essential software like Google Chrome, for example. I think that's the last slide, is it, Alan?
It is indeed.
Alrighty then. If you have any questions, please use the email for the group. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Harvey. Okay, next up we have quite an interesting share, I think, from Alison Brinda. So, Alison, if you want to unmute and you can talk us through the deck.
Thanks, Alan. I was just going to talk a bit about the Allison database that I found recently because I was looking for information about my father's family who are Polish, but they had been deported to Germany during World War II and then came to Canada as displaced persons in 1950. So I didn't know where to start at all, and I just kind of Googled and found this database, which had some information. I think they're still adding more documents all the time, and there is some general information on it, articles, things like that. It is available in different languages, you can see on the upper right there. But I just did very simple searches, so I was just going to show you what I had done. The next slide, please. So, yeah, it's an archive on information about victims and survivors of Nazi persecution. You don't need an account to search it. There is some guides on there, different filters. And you can search it comes up with records for people and for topics. So next slide. So I just started by clicking on that green search the online archive button. And next slide. And then this is what comes up, and you just have to agree to those terms of use. And next slide. So on the right, you can see I did watch and read a little bit of this before I started searching. You can see there some of the filters too that are available if you need them. If you go to the next slide, please. I just started really simple and just typed in my last name, and I thought, I'll refine it if I need to, but I didn't really find that I needed to. You can see there under people, 175 records came up, and I'll come back to that, but if you go to the next slide, please, and then under topics, I had 23 records come up, and so you can see the names there, so you can easily just scroll through and pick out the people that you're looking for. If you go to the next slide, Alan, thanks. So that went, Vladislav is my grandfather's name, so I assumed that was a record about him. And when you click on the plus sign, it gives you the date and place of birth. So then I did know that it was my grandfather. And to the right, you can see that there are some documents there. One thing I saw in the guide was that that little number that's there, I think it's a 2 on that record. If it's highlighted in yellow, it means that the documents have been uploaded, so you can see them. And if you go to the next slide, that's one of the documents. You can go to the next one too, please. That's just, it's just, it shows it a bit closer up. So it's, this is the application for assistance that they filled out in order to be able to come to Canada. The whole document is there. Next slide. So going back up to people, I found, even though there was 175, I could easily just scroll through and pick out the ones that I wanted to look at. The ones that are there with the name Alexander, and then the birth, that's the birth date in that column. So I knew those were my father. And then the one that I've highlighted though, that's my grandmother, Alfreda. And I, you know, you can be pretty sure because the birth date's there. Also, sometimes the place of birth is there in, I think, the third column. Like there is for that one there. And if you go to the next slide, it just, it shows that's just one of those documents that was there for her. It's a displaced person's registration record. So that was as much as I looked at it. It's pretty simple. There's probably more there, but yeah. Thanks for making those slides, Alan.
Yeah, it's a good start. Alison, thank you very much for doing that. And we talked earlier about if you have topics that you'd like to share with the group, but you're not a PowerPoint guru, and Chris and I, we've made a few PowerPoint slides now and again, so we can probably help. And that was an example. Alison sent me a bunch of screenshots and some great text, and all I had to do was just drop things together on various slides. So really easy way to share a topic with the group here.
And if you do ask us for help putting together the slides, we will share those slides with you prior to displaying them at Q&A. So you can let us know if we captured the information correctly. And if you want, we can speak to the slides as they come up, or as Alison did, you can speak to the slides as they come up, and we can just have Alan arrow through them as you want to go to new slides. Happy to help.
Okay, so thanks very much, Alison, for that. And here's an example of somebody who sent something in. Stuart wants to promote the idea of looking far and wide for medications or medical supplies anyway. Stuart needed some medical supplies, and the hospital told him to just go to the drugstore because they have everything. However, he found that the drugstore, the cost was going to be like $50 a week for a number of weeks. So he looked around the web and he found various online suppliers that would basically give you the same products for 20% less. And in particular, he wants to recommend this CanMed Direct, where shipping is free on orders more than $150. And if you don't spend that much, then it's an $8 flat fee for shipping and handling. Okay, thanks very much for that, Stuart. Next up is an item from Chris.
That's for me. I'm just going to paste in the stuff into the chat. This was something I found really fascinating. Veritasium, they do YouTube videos as a channel, and they do scientific explainers. And some of them are quite involved. This one is, I believe, over an hour long. But they can be really, really fascinating to watch. So this one was about, you know, the world's most complex machine and how it saved Moore's Law. So Moore's Law was quoted first by Moore of Intel in 1965, and he predicted that the number of components on integrated circuits doubled every, started off with 1 year, and then quite quickly it went to every 1.5 years. Later it's been revised to every 2 years, and now it's really every 3 years. But it's basically, you know, a pretty quick doubling of capabilities of processors. And processors all depend on lithography. So integrated circuits, the way that they get created is they pass light through a mask and it etches onto components, onto a wafer. And the gains that they always got were through using shorter and shorter wavelengths of light, which allowed them to make smaller components on the integrated circuits. And then about 2015, they hit a wall. And there were problems with going to shorter and shorter wavelengths of light, and they basically were down to as small a component as they could possibly do. Until somebody came up with the idea of extreme ultraviolet lithography. And this allowed the Moore's Law to actually continue because it allowed smaller and smaller components. So the light, this is really fascinating stuff. The light actually gets generated by, there's tiny droplets of molten tin, roughly the size of a white blood cell, shot out of basically a cannon at 250 kilometers an hour. The lead droplets are hit by a laser. Three times, each drop is hit three times in 20 microseconds, heats it up to over 220,000 degrees Kelvin, which is 40 times hotter than the surface of the sun, and it basically makes it into a supernova. And they hit 60,000 droplets every second. And when one of the researchers or the people in the company were asked, how many did they miss? And they say, oh, we don't miss. So it's really quite fascinating. And then the light that gets generated by that is the extreme ultraviolet light that they need to do the lithography. And the fascination goes on because it bounces off a whole bunch of mirrors so smooth that it's scaled up to the size of Germany. The largest bump would be 1 millimeter. And they've gone beyond that already. Their latest machines have scaled up to the size of the Earth. The largest bump on the mirror would be the thickness of a playing card. Absolutely astounding. They said that if you have this mirror and you're aiming it and you put a dime on the moon, they could decide whether the light is going to hit the left side of the dime or the right side of the dime. That's how accurate their aiming of the mirrors is. When they first started developing the extreme ultraviolet lithography, the engineers were actually laughed at when they presented papers. They were humiliated. And all of the peers were happy to point out how the crazy ideas, they just wouldn't work or anything like that at all. And in the YouTube tech, the Veritasium video, he quotes George Bernard Shaw as saying, the unreasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. I think that's a fascinating way of looking at things. And Casper Mebius, who's the narrator in this video, he actually says, we owe our lives to unreasonable people because all of the tech that you enjoy day to day now were all created by people that came up with unreasonable ideas. Now, in continuing on and reading on some of the topics, there seems to be a shift now going in place. Rather than worrying about Moore's Law in order to double the components on an integrated circuit every 3 years and therefore get performance gains at equal or less dollar value, which some experts do expect this to continue on for quite a period of time, but yet. What they're really thinking now, a lot of them, are that the expansion of the capabilities are going to come through the increased abilities of AI. And so we're seeing in this chart, you know, it's the performance of some AI tasks, and they specifically picked out coding, are now doubling every few months. And so the sophistication of what can be done in a given time frame is just going right through the roof with the additional capabilities of AI. Now, to counter that, I did hear a podcast just today that talked about how AI improvements are slowing dramatically. In the early times, ancient history of like a year or two ago, AI was doubling like this every few months. and they say now it's slowing down, so that the doubling is really happening. You know, it's in the year time frame and things like that. So who knows? But at any rate, if you're interested in this sort of stuff at all, I found that Veritasium video absolutely fascinating to watch. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I'm going to give that a whirl in my microwave, I think. Should be able to generate something like that, shouldn't we? Maybe not. Yeah, fascinating technology indeed. Okay, talking about AI, we're going to carry on with my mini-series on vibe coding. And you'll recall last week we went through some details on how to produce a very simple website that basically the homepage looked exactly like this. And what I said was that how are you going to make it a bit fancier? And I said, I have an idea. And I was asking you to send me your ideas, and I would run them as a follow-up. But, of course, nobody sent me any ideas, so you're stuck with my idea. All right, so I do have an idea, just as an example, again, of what we might do. So here's the follow-up prompt to my initial prompt to build the website and jazz it up with a square box and centered text and that kind of stuff. So I'm now telling ChatGPT, I think it is. Yes, it is. I'm telling it to modify the code that it's just developed to display the logos for both the OPCUG and the CBC to the left of the two entries on our webpage. So we have the text, we have the link, and now we're going to have the logo on the same web page. So we've got text and graphics in our HTML page. You remember the rules are you just tell it what you want. I just told it what I want. And then you just hit this copy button. You paste it into a file and you run it and see what happens. And what happens is this. And you can probably see that we've got logos. However, I notice that down here, this is in fact the CBC logo, which is good. But this is some kind of generic logo. That is not the official logo for the R2R PC users group. So what I need is some kind of real logo, a custom logo, whatever. So I'm going to say, how do I add a custom logo for OPCUG? And it tells me, well, you want to replace the current favicon-based image tag, with one that points to your own image file. So this is kind of interesting. I didn't realize, I've done a lot of HTML coding, I've made quite a number of websites, but I never realized that a lot of websites have a default icon stored on their web server. So clearly what ChatGPT did in response to my prompt was it went to the CBC website, and it found an icon that in this fav icon format, that little red circular type thing, and it used that as a logo. Clearly, it went to the OPCUG website, and it didn't find our logo in that format. I don't know whether it found the generic one in that format or it truly is generic. Anyway, it didn't. What we need to do is get our own image file. So it says if it's on the online somewhere, then you can use a kind of an image tag like this. I don't think our logo is. It may be available somewhere on the website, but on the homepage, it's part of a header, and I don't think you can just pull it out like that. However, there's a second option which ChatGPT tells us about, and it says put the file, for example, opcuglogo.png. in the same folder as the HTML file that it's using to generate the web page. And you notice here it says, if you want, I can update your HTML code. Just tell me the file name that you plan to use, or paste the image here. Well, I don't know what the image is, but I can tell it where it is. So I thought, well, I can just click one of these icons here somewhere and and upload an image. So I went for this probably More here and then Plus or something, More rather, and add a photo or file. So I'm saying, okay, I know I have a file already on my hard drive. I just want to add that file to the image. So I told it to go ahead and do that. And here's the image being added. And silly me, I thought, well, it's going to, look for it where it found it and make the appropriate link. And it seems as though it's done that. It's found the right image, and I've got some text here. So again, I'm going to use that vibe coding thing. Just grab the code from copy here, paste it into my file, and I still don't quite have the right logo. Now, it had the right picture, and it's got the right alternate text, but again, it doesn't have the actual logo. And that's actually my fault, because I didn't really read what it said, because we're doing this cut and paste thing, right? What it said down here is, I've integrated your logo into the menu, but just make sure to place the file, the PNG file, in the same folder as website.htm. Now, I hadn't done that. I told it, go get this PNG file from a location on my hard drive, and I thought it would take care of it, but it didn't. It wants me to put that PNG file into the same folder where I'm developing this HTML code. So if I do that, if I move that image to the right spot on my hard drive, lo and behold, I have both logos next to the appropriate text and hyperlinks. Okay, so here's the full amount of code right here. And what does it say next? Oh, all right. I don't know anything about HTML coding, or maybe you don't, and maybe we're doing vibe coding, so we don't really need to know, but perhaps we'd like to find out. Maybe we'd like to find out something about HTML. The way to do that quickly is just ask the chatbot, how does this code work, right? I don't know anything about coding. Please explain the code that you developed. Sure, I'll tell you all about it in clear beginner-friendly language. These bots are just wonderful, aren't they? So your page displays a title. It shows two sections. Inside each section is a logo, there's a hyperlink, and everything's in a box center, which is exactly what we asked for, if you remember, in these multiple prompts. And then if we go down a bit further, it says, okay, well, here's your starting structure. We've got this thing called, this is a tag. A doc type is, the document type is HTML. Tells the browser that this is an HTML web page. The HTML tag begins the page. It doesn't tell us about the language is English, but I think that's pretty obvious. And then the header has some settings, like the title. Again, interestingly, it doesn't explain what a meta tag is, which is kind of interesting. That's really obscure, so you'd probably like to know what meta tags are. And then, what the title is and what the body is and so forth and so forth. So it tells you basically what's going on. And then to get down to this line right here, I mean, we can read this in English almost. This is a division in the code. The style has a margin of 50 pixels. Remember, we asked for 50 pixels of white space all around the text. We're going to have a border of 2 pixels. It decided that by default. The border is going to be solid black. I don't remember whether I asked for a black border, but that's what I'm getting. I'm having 50 pixels of padding, which is the white space, and then align the text to be centered on the page, right? And there it will tell you all about the stuff in terms of the 50 pixels here is the outside the box, the padding 50 pixels inside the box. So it tells you exactly what that line of code does. So if you're interested in doing vibe coding, just tell it what you want, and then when it doesn't quite work, tell it to do something differently, tell it what it got wrong, tell it to do something different. If you really want to know what's going on, just ask it to explain its code. So the question now is, Well, I've given you a brief introduction to vibe coding. What do you want to generate in terms of a computer program, maybe a utility program, a script to do something, a PowerShell script, let's say, a macro for Excel or Microsoft Word, and what you want to, a chatbot, doesn't have to be ChatGPT, but you can certainly use the low-level AI chatbots to do this kind of simple vibe coding. And I'll be coming back to this next week with a new twist on what you might want to do in future. Okay, so that has hit the last 10, Chris. We've actually done it for once. For the last 10 minutes that we have open for questions.
And I don't see anything in the chat. If anybody does have something right now, by all means, unmute yourself and ask it or throw it into the chat. Green asks Alan if you've been replaced with ChatGPT.
Not yet, but it's coming, I'm sure.
Yeah, that and perplexity.ai. And why?
How about Jacinta? She had some questions.
What is ChatGPT?
ChatGPT is what's known as a chatbot. So it's an AI, that artificial intelligence, that you can go and pose questions to and things like that, and it will do its best to try to come up with the answers for you. I do give a presentation. I give it a number of times at the coming up at the Ottawa Public Library. I'll also be giving it at the September meeting of the PC User Group on how to use ChatGPT and other AI tools that are available out there.
Thank you.
Mike on his laptop has a problem with a stuck update, and we've been discussing this over email. Right now he says he's no experience with Microsoft Update Catalog. Does anybody have any experience using that?
I have used it before, and basically it's various updates that you can apply to a computer without doing it through the regular Windows Update page. My understanding is that a lot of the KB articles, rather than being bundled as a monthly update, you can get the individual updates available through the Microsoft Catalog. So I think it's organized by KB article number, which is, KB is a knowledge base. And so most of the things like updates and things like that Microsoft does has a KB article associated with it where you can see the details of what the particular update does. I don't know if that's a complete explanation of it. Anybody else has any other experience with the update catalog? By all means, chime in.
The other thing that I'm thinking of in terms of problems with Windows Update, there is a Windows Update troubleshooter which you can run. Sometimes it does things and sometimes it doesn't.
I've also given a presentation on a script you can do to reinitialize Windows Update if Windows Update is not behaving correctly. And I can mention that, I guess, in next week's Q&A. I could do a quick recap of it.
I was using the Microsoft Catalog the other day for unknown devices that show up in Device Manager. You can get the hardware ID and then put that into the catalog thing and be able to get what the driver is that it says is unknown.
Oh, that's really useful.
Yeah, it is if it works.
A couple of people have hands up. Let's start off with Richard Bradford.
Yes.
What?
For a while,
hello.
I've been.
Excuse me. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes. For a while, I've been trying to find something to stop unnecessary background processes starting up, and I finally got the answer this morning in the APCUG meeting that. There's a utility called AutoRuns, but it comes up with a very large, complicated list of programs that you can tick or untick. But it would be nice to have a little bit more information about that, of what programs you don't want to stop starting up on machine boot up time.
Might want to check our archive. I think Tom Trottier had talked about auto runs a few weeks ago, maybe. Tom?
Or a few months ago. There are a whole bunch of auto runs in different places all over Windows. The start folder is just one of them. And you can turn things on and off. And ordinarily, there's a whole bunch of stuff there for programs you've installed. There's also stuff for devices that you have connected. And so it's, I don't think there's any standard catalog of what you can and can't turn off. For example, one of the categories is services, and you can turn the services on and off. You can stop them, you can start them, you can make them automatic. Automatic means that they come on when you either log on or start the machine. And there's probably 100 or 200 services running in everybody's computer. And as well as that, that's just one of the categories in auto runs. So if you go through auto runs, basically turn off the things that are bothering you that do not seem to connect to anything that you're using or any device. You can also look them up on Google to see whether you can deactivate them without any bad things happening, because you do not want to put your computer into a state where it will not boot again. This can be awkward. So Google each of the – turn off the things that you don't want happening. I don't know. For example, I'm getting a Discord thing when it patched my PC, updated it, and now it's starting at the with Windows, and I'm going to turn that off soon, probably just after this meeting. There are other things that you can easily kind of turn off without any bad things happening. But anything that you're unsure of, Google it and see how whether it can or can't be turned off. Or ask perplexity.ai. I'm using that more often than I am Google.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Richard has his hand up.
Yes, thank you. I was just to go back to Chris's comment about him making a presentation at one of the libraries. Do you have those details on the top of your head, Chris, or?
Yeah, what I could do I can actually share a screen. You've got an abbreviated list of them, eh?
Yeah, well, you can add to that. We're almost out of time, so let's go to the wrap-up right now.
Okay.
All right, so I just remind everybody, we don't know what you know, what you don't know, so if you have questions, just tell us and we'll see what we can do. If you're a member of the club and you have a question that doesn't fit in with Q&A or the members-only forum, we do have this one-on-one remote assistance program where you tell us what the problem is and we think it is applicable to this remote control assistance type thing. And we have a panel of experts who will help you by connecting to your computer and trying to fix whatever your problem is. Chris had mentioned, if you aren't a member, then we have this special 2 years for the price of one. And if you are a member, then your membership is automatically renewed, so you don't need to do anything. But we do have this special where you give us $20 if you're not a member, and we'll give you 2 years rather than a single year. Here's the list of the OPL presentations which are coming up. It should look familiar. This is the one I tried to give you last week, kind of 2 weeks ahead of time. Thursday the 29th, which is tomorrow, Aunt Linda is doing armchair travel session for British Columbia at the Rosemount branch. Chris is going to be talking about artificial intelligence, if you don't know about AI. He's got fun and useful tips at the main library branch downtown on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. And if your machine is running slow, or maybe it's not running at all, Windows Performance Tune-Up at the Saneron branch on Monday the 2nd. Anything you want to add to that, Chris?
Yeah. Do you have any more slides?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, and then I'm going to I'll wrap up with showing.
Well, you can talk about that one. You can talk about this one.
Oh, okay. Linda, are you still online? Did you want to talk to this? Linda's actually going to be presenting this.
Sure. I'm actually going to do one of the bonus presentations that we're starting this year. I decided I would do one on the armchair travel that I give on beautiful British Columbia. So it's basically just a narration with my photos and some from Chris. I've been to BC many, many, many times, so lots of different areas and topics, and even some photos from the 1920s if you're interested in historic photography. And it's going to take place on Tuesday evening, so not the usual Wednesday because it's a bonus. And so that's March 3rd, 7 p.m. And it'll be probably less than an hour long, but say an hour with questions or comments. And then the Zoom link is there. It's also going to be in the newsletter. Coming newsletter. Is that
and it's in the chat as well.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thank you very much. Another upcoming event in 2 weeks, February 11th, will be our regular monthly meeting. A couple of pretty disreputable characters, I think, going to be talking about electronic mail, everything you wanted to know but were afraid to ask, I think. And that's it for my slides. Just remind you that next Wednesday is another Q&A, so if you have questions, there's lots of information in the chat about how to get old questions and into new questions. We're always looking for new questions. We're always looking for topics that people would like to share, like Harvey and Allison tonight. Thanks for that, Harvey and Allison. So if you have information that you want to send us, there's our email address, always open for business.
And Jacinta, I see you have a question about iClouds. We are sort of out of time tonight. We can keep things going a little bit after the presentation, but people start to drop off quite quickly. So you could send an email into that email address, suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll make sure that it's in the queue for next Wednesday's Q&A. And so thanks very much for everybody who came out tonight. And let me just stop my share.
And I'll just say while you're doing that, Chris, that there's a number of questions in the chat that I think we should take a look at. We'll follow up for next week.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. Thanks a lot, folks.